something?
Would you loan me, please, something?
I'd loan you out. Calling Labor and Commerce to order. It is May 4th, thank God Almighty, and it's almost 2 o'clock. And we have with us today Senator Davis, Senator Seekins, Senator Stevens, and myself, Bundy. First thing on our agenda today, confirmation hearings. We have some bills previously heard, HB 418, the Real Estate Commission with a possible amendment, HB 540, HCR 23, HB 490, HB 559, HB 512, HB 272, HB 542, and HB 421. Where were these people in February? Confirmation hearings. I had asked you folks if you had any additional concerns, if we needed the people to appear or be on teleconference. I did not hear from you. We do have a confirmee to the Board of Marine Pilots, Jack Paulson, Esquire from Funo, and this does not reflect any intent by any member to vote for or against him or her in future sessions, and without objection, we will move this name forward. You got to sign it. Okay. We have had on again, off again discussions of HB 91. We've had all the public testimony I think we need, and we have it before us for possible action. What's the will of the committee?
I'd vote on
this. Mr. Chairman, I'd move to
that we forward House Bill 91 from committee with individual recommendations in the attached fiscal note.
Jane?
Senator Davis?
Yes.
Senator Stevens?
Yes.
Senator Seekins?
Yes.
Senator Bundy?
No. So, 91 moves forward. That brings us to 418, and I have in the members' packet, don't I? No, I don't. The possible amendment?
Yeah.
418. Do we have additional public testimony on 418? Hearing none, we'll close public testimony. I have an amendment for our consideration and discussion. I would move and object to amendment number one. It's backslash I.3, just for discussion purposes. If the committee recalls the last time we had Pat Davidson here, the director of LB&A, they had indicated that they had two recommendations that go along with the extension of the termination date. One was that mobile homes fall under real estate licensee. I've been told that that issue is under discussion by the real estate board, and perhaps we don't need to address that at this point. Let the record show that Senator French has joined us. The other, however, was raising the fees from $10,000 to $20,000, and our 418. And as this was a recommendation of our LB&A committee, committee that we spend a good deal of time asking our various auditors to come back with recommendations, feel an obligation to address their recommendations. So we have before us amendment number one. And the bill's representative, the bill sponsor is here. Would you like to address this amendment or potential amendment?
Senator
For the record, my name is Janet Seif, staff to Representative Roepberg, and he apologizes that he's chairing a Rules Committee meeting at the moment. Representative Roepberg is not in favor of raising the limit for a couple of reasons. One, the raised limit could impact the licensee fees for the real estate agents, the license fees they currently pay. And two, he believes that anything above $10,000 you should take to court.
Thank you. Do we have other an amendment number one? We don't. Committee have questions for Ms. Seif? Senator Seekins.
Are you aware of payments having been made out on what kind of frequency and what amount?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that Pat Davidson and the audit set forth that the recent payments were all above $10,000 and more in the $20,000 range, and that is reflected in the audit.
Okay, thank you, Ann. And on the front of your packet, there is a graph that I asked. Oh, okay. Well, in your packet is a graph, and wanted to share with the committee. Here's a selection of states that administer a real estate recovery fund, and Alaska's at 10,000. They are joined by 1, 2, 3, 4 other states that are 10,000 or less. The rest of these states are 15,000 to 50,000. And Pat is here, so did you get your question answered?
Well, not really. If we could just, if there's some indication of how often this is used.
Okay, thank you.
What the
thank
disbursement
you,
rate level is.
Pat, welcome for the record.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Pat Davidson from the Division of Legislative Audit. I apologize to the committee for my delay in appearing.
Our schedule's running a little bit loose. We are discussing proposed amendment number one, which would raise the surety limit from 10 to 20,000, as LBNA has report had recommended. I just shared with the committee a selection of what other states have for their surety fee. And the question from Senator Seekins was, what have the past claims been like? Do they tend to go above 10,000? And do you have information you could share with us?
Certainly. Our review, our audit, will usually cover about a four-year period. And so what we're looking at are disbursements made out of the surety fund over the last 4 years. And what we saw is, in terms of actual payments going out of the surety fund, there were five of them. And all the actual claims reported and substantiated by the hearing officers, actual claims for damages were all in excess of $10,000, and one was in excess of $20,000. So that was one of the main reasons we recommended that the threshold be moved from $10,000 to $20,000.
And they're seeking.
And what's the size of the fund now?
Through the chair, Senator Seekins, I can tell you what the balance of the fund at the end of fiscal year 03 was, and that was $467,000. It has a floor of, I believe it's $250,000, and originally it was supposed to have a cap of $500,000. The other thing that's in statute is individuals, there's a cap on how much a per licensee would pay the fund for surety, and I think it's capped at $125. And I don't remember whether that's every year or 2 years, but I think right now it's like $60. So they're nowhere near as either. They're quite close to the ceiling of the surety fund itself, and they're still making substantially less than the maximum contributions to the fund.
And they're secret.
So if based on the history of the number of claims, if we went to the $20,000 maximum, it doesn't seem to be any foreseeable shrinkage of the size of the fund based on our last 5 years history, 4 years history?
Through the chairman, Senator Seekins, It doesn't necessarily appear so. There certainly seems to appear to be enough funds in there. However, you're talking about individual claims, and they might run differently in terms of cycles, or there's not really a predictable nature of them.
And this 10,000 fee was set how many years ago?
Mr. Chairman, it was set back in 76 or 80.
Well, a substantial while ago. I'll settle for that. Understand that there probably has, inflation has occurred since it was originally set.
Mr. Chairman, it was actually set in 1974 when the Real Estate Surety Fund was first established in statute. And actually, if you use the CPI to inflation, it would go up over $30,000. But when we looked at the history and the payments going out, we thought a $20,000 ceiling was the prudent recommendation.
And a concern that Representative Roepberg's staff was that the amount of real estate licenses would then go up. Do you have information about that and what that impact might be?
Mr. Chairman, the certainly payments into the Real Estate Surety Fund are from the licensees. If you have more payments out of the fund, then you would expect that the fees by those licensees is going to go up. However, these are the claims for the real losses that are being incurred by people who use the services. As I mentioned, the statutes were amended in 1998, limiting that the fee to be set, that a licensee could be paid, can be no more than $125. However, the current fee is set at $30 per licensee. So we're quite a bit below that maximum amount.
Other questions for Pat? Senator French.
Just a general observation, Mr. Chairman. As always, when these matters are under consideration, I have a conflict of interest. My wife is engaged in this business profession.
Noted. Further questions? Seeing none, is there, I remove my objection. There are other objections to amendment number one. Seeing none, we've adopted amendment number one, the will of the committee.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move House Bill 418 out of committee with individual recommendations of the past system.
Okay. Thank you, Pat.
Yes.
Senator Davis?
Yes.
Senator Seacon?
Yes.
Senator Bundy?
Yes. 418 is on its way. That brings us to House Bill 540. And do we have a representative? There we go. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Josh Appleby, staff to Representative Tom Anderson, chair of the House Labor and Commerce Committee. House Bill 540 is a piece of legislation that addresses a long-standing problem with Alaska worker compensation lost cost filings. The issue was brought to members of the House Labor and Commerce Committee and led to the introduction of this bill. The bill places into statute a more open and transparent process that gives stakeholders in the system an opportunity for input and understanding of the lost cost filings, which are a fundamental building block of the worker compensation rates. At its initial hearing, the Division of Insurance voiced concerns on timeline and process issues. At the request of the committee, the Division of Insurance and the company who brought forward the issue worked together to produce the committee substitute before you today. This version has both of their full support. Representatives are both here to explain and answer any questions that the members may have.
questions for the bill sponsor? Seeing none, we do have off-net Craig Nordveldt from Alaska National Insurance to answer questions. Is there anyone, excuse me, here who would like to testify on House Bill 540? Mr. Miller.
Good afternoon. I appreciate the opportunity to testify on behalf of HB 540. For the record, my name is Charlie Miller. I'm here today representing Alaska National Insurance Company, one of the work comp carriers here in Alaska. Loss costs are the basic component of what becomes work comp rates. What happens in the system is the rating agency reviews previous data and then basically tries to project through assumptions and what the loss cost will be in the upcoming rate year. Then they take their loss costs and they plug it into the other rating factors, either regulatory rating factors or through underwriting factors, and then you'll get your rate at the end of it. The loss cost itself is pretty clinical. It's an actuarial exercise. The process at this point we had felt was a little too closed, and we were hoping to open the process up a little bit and be able to participate more as well as other stakeholders. We're real pleased with the product that the Division of Insurance helped with. They were actually quite a bit of difference, and which we feel it's a much better bill than it was when we brought the issue up. Depending on what the committee's wishes are, we can get into a little more detail of what this does, but it's a process that we go through every year. Accuracy, as close as you can get actuarially, is real fundamental to this. It's not designed to produce higher or lower rates or loss cost filings. It's to provide accurate ones.
We do have someone from Division of Insurance, and perhaps we could ask their view of the bill. Thank you. Sarah? Welcome. For the record, please.
My name is Sarah McNair Grove, and I'm the property casualty actuary with the Division of Insurance. We worked very closely with Alaska National in preparing this bill, and we feel that we've come up with a good process that meets both of our needs, and we would ask you to support this bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have on it.
Questions? Senator Frank.
It sounds like you're just trying to make a better model for predicting future costs.
Through the chair, Senator French, it's the review process for those assumptions that are made. Currently, NCCI, the National Council on Compensation Insurance, is an organization that does all of the actuarial analysis. They present it to the division. We review it for compliance with Alaska law and either approve or disapprove or ask for changes. In that process, it is the division and the National Council on Compensation Insurance. The insurers don't really have any input into it, and this process would open up a public hearing as we begin to review it so that they can have input and say, we'd like you to consider this or review this a little bit closer. So it makes it a more public open process than currently exists.
Given the funding issues in the workers' comp system, some folks might just sort of suppose this is a way of raising rates to cover their past losses.
Through the chair, Senator French, that's not the intent of this. The intent is that more stakeholders would have the ability to raise questions, provide information in the process, so that it's not just the division and the rating organization, but the users of those rates would have some ability, the insurers as well as employers. I mean, it's open to everybody.
It'd be fair to say that the actuarial assumptions may not change, but the input that you use to arrive at those assumptions may be brought.
That's correct. The actuarial work should not change. It's the ability for more people to be involved in the process of the final approval of those rates.
Other questions? Seeing none, thank you. We do have off-net Bob Lohr, who would like to testify. Mr. Lohr?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll keep this very brief because I know your time is precious. I'm testifying as a former director of the division, but testifying for myself. I think this is good legislation, and I would urge you to move it quickly. I have a couple of small comments about specific provisions of the bill, but overall, I think the bill is very worthwhile and ought to be moved expeditiously. There's a very detailed hearing process set out for these filings by a rating organization. Typically, this might be the National Council on Compensation Insurance, that starts on page 3, section 3, on line 3 of the bill. Within that, on line 24 of page 3, there's a very tight time frame there for the director to hold a hearing. It's within 20, no earlier than 20 days, no later than 25 days after receipt of a filing. I just point out that's a very, very tight time frame for a hearing, and whether that's adequate window or not to conduct a hearing. And then on page 5 of the bill, lines 15 and 16, this makes the records of the hearing public record, and I support that. I think that's very worthwhile. In the past, there was some doubt about the availability of records, and this clarifies that they are available. Continuing on page 5, line 18, requires that the rating organization make available the information as soon as possible. You might consider saying immediately, to simply make it clear that once the filing is out there, it ought to be available to interested parties and the public. And then a very small point also on the same page 5, line 22, it says the order must include details of the director's reasoning. I presume that means the order must state the director's reasoning, and I'm not sure why include would be used rather than simply to state. And then finally, on page 6 of the bill, the definition, the final definition in the bill, which is page 6, lines 22 through 25, a prospective loss cost filing is a term defined, but it doesn't really label it as a filing submitted by a rating organization. And if, just for comparison purposes, if you look at the definition of assigned risk pool rate filing on lines 10 through 12, that term is defined as a filing. I think the intent of the prospective loss cost filing is to label it as a filing, but if so, and if SCS is otherwise needed, then just making it explicit that it is a filing submitted by a rating organization consisting of, or language to that effect. Those are the sum total of my comments. Again, I urge you to move the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Sarah, may I ask you to join us again? Starting with the time frame, do you feel the concern of Mr. Lohr is such that we should delay action on the bill?
Actually, that was probably at our suggestion. We did know that this was a very tight time frame, but it is simply the time frame in which we can determine whether a hearing would be held. And I think we will know fairly quickly after we get the filing whether or not it's going to be require a lot of work if there are a lot of changes to the methodology. And so this time frame is simply for other people to provide input, and we're comfortable with it.
Thank you. And on the issue, as soon as possible, for the record, would you indicate that that is a very short period of time and that the word immediately would be nearly interchangeable?
They're the same to me, and I've talked with the rating organization, and we will use websites as soon as they get the information and have a 24-hour turnaround or something to get it up on their website, and we've discussed those issues.
The chair's a little hesitant to do too much wordsmithing at this time in the session.
I believe that the language is there is adequate to convey the concept.
And the final concern about the filing, do you...
Again, maybe a small technical thing, but I don't think it's I don't think it hurts the language that's there. And it mirrors the language that we have in our regulations, which is where that definition came from.
Other questions? Seeing none, any amendments? Seeing none, the will of the committee?
Chairman, move House, CS for House Bill number 540 out of committee with individual recommendations attached fiscal note.
Thank you, Jane.
Senator French?
Yes.
Senator Stevens?
Yes.
Senator Keating?
Yes.
Senator Davis?
Yes.
Senator Bundy?
Yes. That brings us to HCR 32, Alaska Information Infrastructure Policy Task Force.
A mouthful, isn't it, Senator?
But in your family, you could set that to music.
I'm going to give it my best shot.
Welcome, and for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sue Stancliffe. I am staff to Speaker Cott. Before you is HCR 32. This is a labor and commerce, I take that back. That's the next one that I'm going to be doing. This is Speaker Cott's bill. HCR 32 establishes the Alaska Information Infrastructure Policy Task Force, which will be charged with consideration of Alaska's role and interest in long-term information infrastructure development. The development of information infrastructure will provide Alaska communities with access to broadband connectivity and provide for telecommunications, healthcare, education, homeland security, and economic development opportunities. Access to fiber optic connectivity will help bridge the divide that separates rural Alaska and the benefits of technological advances realized in urban Alaska. Public-private partnerships have been used successfully around the globe to facilitate information infrastructure development. The Progressive Policy Institute has a new economic index. It's a new economy index, and I believe in your package you have copies of it. It tells an interesting story where Alaska is nationally in the new economy and how competitive Alaska has been in the past few years. The new economy index was released in 1999 and in 2002. And interestingly, in 1999, Alaska was ranked 13th most competitive state in the new index. By 2002, Alaska had dropped to the 31st most competitive state, registering the sharpest drop in the index of all of the states. We're losing ground, Mr. Chairman, and this task force can address the question of how Alaska can get back on track. In Ireland, Ireland's information technology infrastructure is a shining example of what Alaska can achieve and surpass through public-private partnerships. The Irish government and its partners planned and developed a fiber optic infrastructure. Ireland subsequently became a major player in the global economy. Today, Ireland is the largest exporter of software products in Europe, home to 300 leading electronic companies and a base of 9 of the top 10 pharmaceutical companies in the world. In 2000, Ireland exported $13.3 billion worth of knowledge-based products to the global marketplace. This is not out of reach for Alaska. Fiber optic cables run deep beneath the sea, currently providing state-of-the-art telecommunications from Alaska's largest urban hubs to the lower 48 and the rest of the world. The fiber optic cable already stretches between Prudhoe Bay, Fairbanks, Anchorage, and Juneau. Alaska's communities are dispersed across its immense landscape, and the gap in the infrastructure are the result of federal land laws, vast distances, and the relative newness of our state. A paved highway may never connect some of our small towns and villages outside, but the telecommunications superhighway can link them all. Innovative engineering concepts and robust technologies in use today can be put to use in Alaska, hardwiring far-flung communities to logistic hubs. With a telecommunications superhighway, Alaska economy can evolve into a 21st century economic powerhouse. The proposed task force is a much needed step, Mr. Chairman. Similar efforts have been undertaken by other states to determine how state government can use its resources to create an environment in which the private sector has the incentive to provide information technology, usually through broadband fiber-based technology, to small and rural markets. Colorado, Minnesota, North Carolina, Oregon, and Vermont have developed statewide information technology strategies to help bridge their digital divide. By enhancing the economic competitiveness of the rural areas and transforming the overall economies of these forward-thinking states. And, Mr. Chairman, it is our intent that the task force here identify what we need in the state, come back to the legislature with the recommendations, any necessary legislation to bring us forward, and carry that through.
Questions? We do have a couple of folks that would like to testify here in Juneau with Stan Herrera.
Join us, please.
Good afternoon. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. For the record, my name is Stan Herrera. I'm the Director and Chief Technology Officer for the State of Alaska and also Director of the Enterprise Technology Services Division within the Department of Administration. My purpose for testifying this afternoon is to apprise you of a potential oversight by members of the House in reference to HCR 32. This is the resolution to establish the Alaska Information Infrastructure Task Force. The resolution as submitted identifies 13 members to this task force without any representation of the Department of Administration. The Department of Administration Enterprise Technology Services currently provides all centralized data processing, data communications, and telecommunications for the state agencies identified by Alaska statute. On March 5th of this year, I submitted a memorandum to the Speaker of the House and members of the House Finance Committee documenting my concerns and recommendations to have consideration to put the Department of Administration in within that task force. If the true purpose of the task force is to review and analyze the state's current and long-term information infrastructure, in my opinion, a key player on this task force would be a representative from the Department of Administration. I respectfully request that this resolution be amended to include a representative from the Department of Administration, the commissioner, or his designee. And thank you for your time and consideration in this matter. Any questions, I'm free to answer.
Thank you. Question for Ms. Herrera? Thank you. I see the, as all good task force, they have odd number, and that would mean that we would have to either, if we chose in our wisdom to add the Department of Administration, we'd either have to remove someone or add two. Or maybe we could remove two. But, I'm seeking wisdom from the committee. Senator French.
I think smaller rather than bigger is probably more efficient. Or you can just remove, add one.
I'm sorry.
When you finish, I have a suggestion.
So you were thinking Senator French's suggestion was remove one and make an addition, if that's what our
add one wisdom to.
Senator David?
I was looking at the resolution, and it has three members of the legislature chosen by the Speaker of the House and the President of the Senate. Are we count that as a group, or is that three members added making the 13? Because if it's representing one, it's not a, it wouldn't help. But if that's representing three people, we could cut it to two and still add somebody. So I don't know how they represent it. Does that make the total 13?
Yeah, why they would take three, because right. Then you'd either be top heavy from the House or the Senate.
Yeah.
Or maybe it only takes two members to make a senator. I mean, teams in districts. In any case. Sue, do you care to comment on the suggestion?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity to comment. Speaker Cott did receive the letter from the Department of Administration and does not support adding the Department of Administration into this because most of the items that we talked about are related to military and veterans affairs, who they are represented in here if you look at Homeland Security and Emergency Services. The other is through economic development, and we do have the community and economic development added to this. Currently, it's my understanding that areas of technology are being shifted over to the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, and I'm not absolutely positive as to what Mr. Herrera is speaking to, the TIC, the Telecommunications Information Council, perhaps, I'm not really sure, but Speaker Cott would prefer not to do that, and if you do have a suggestion, I would have to concur with Senator French that smaller is probably better.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, the chair does have some concern about the unequal representation in the legislature. Three chosen by the speaker, even though they may... So I guess I would entertain an amendment to delete one of the members of the legislature and have it replaced by commissioner or designee of the Department of Administration. Senator French?
Chairman, I tend to agree with you. I guess I was just looking at the list and it says you choose, you know, the Speaker of the House chooses one, the President of the Senate chooses one, and the minority leader typically chooses one. I guess you could collapse those by having the Speaker and the President get together and choose one and having the minority leaders choose one, and that way both sides get one.
Further discussion? Senator Stevens?
Mr. President, I would move the to reduce the members of the legislature to two and then add one member from the Department of Administration.
That's a conceptual amendment. Is it the committee comfortable with that? Then it could be added by the drafters where it's appropriate.
I thought I was going to be comfortable with it, but now that the statement has been made, and this has been in the file since March, about the administration wanting to be a part of this, and we are so close to the end of the session, I don't know if it would be good to do that, because we have to go back and get sent back again to the House, and it's not something that the sponsor of this amendment of this group is not interested in doing that, because if he was, he could have added it before. I hadn't looked at the date on there, but they have this ever since March. So maybe we ought to take that in consideration, because it could kill the whole bill if we have to go through the process of sending it back.
We have one other person that would like to testify off net, so if I could ask you to hold action on your amendment until we get that testimony, and then we can have further discussion. Wynette Ayers.
Thank you, Chairman Bundy and members of the committee. My name is Wynette Ayers, and I'm the Executive Director of the Southwest Alaska Municipal Conference, or SWMCE. SWMCE is the Economic Development District and ARDR for Southwest Alaska. And I'm here today to speak in favor of HDR 32 on behalf of the 54 communities and 132 members of SWMCE. Creation of a state information infrastructure policy task force is a much-needed step in developing a cohesive strategy for information technology and infrastructure in Alaska. Much of my prepared testimony has been paraphrased by Speaker Cott's staff member that was there, so I'll abbreviate my comments, but I do want to point you in the direction of a few resources. First of all, the state of Vermont has done, I think, an outstanding job in developing a comprehensive statewide information technology strategy, and it's available on their website at thinkvermont.com. You've also heard reference to the New Economy Index, and I would just add to that that Alaska ranked 39th in broadband access and 49th in online manufacturers, and our aggregate digital economy ranking was 36. Also, the state of Colorado has done some benchmarking studies of state telecommunications networks, primarily for government services and education. And one of the interesting findings in reading that report comes from the state of Ohio, which 10 years ago integrated a fiber optic backbone with an 800 megahertz radio system, replacing its existing microwave system. The state of Ohio experienced numerous benefits from this process, with an estimated annual savings in excess of $12 million, $20 million in costs avoided by not replacing the state's aging microwave system, and $50 million less in capital expenditures and $1 million less in operating expenditures by not building a standalone radio communication system for public safety and emergency management. Additionally, universities and other agencies realize substantial cost savings for their line charges. There are a number of other resources that I could mention, but I'd like to bring this discussion back to Alaska, and specifically back to Southwest Alaska, where we have the opportunity perhaps to leverage the creation of a fiber optic cable backbone in support of the ground-based mid-course defense system, which will be requiring secure fiber optic cable communications through its site in Alaska. And early estimates indicate that they will this fiber optic backbone may be needed by 2006. This need represents a tremendous opportunity for Southwest Alaska and for the state. The question is, how can we leverage this opportunity and create an environment where communities, telecom providers, and Native corporations and other stakeholders realize the benefits of a fiber optic backbone? Basically, all of these players need to be challenged to develop last-mile solutions that can bring the benefits of fiber optic cable and broadband access to Alaska's remotest communities. I'd like to also add that you heard reference to the development of the economy in Ireland and their investment in information infrastructure. Their success is largely based on a two-prong approach to investing in their economy, the first being education and the second being IT infrastructure. And those dual investments have helped them realize incredible economic growth and future potential. Here in Alaska, we've been working, and there's much discussion about investment in our education system, but at the university level, the Alaska Scholars Program is succeeding in keeping a number of young Alaskans in state to receive their college education. A comprehensive statewide strategy on IT infrastructure is a logical and complementary step to continue stemming the brain drain. As was the case in Ireland, education and IT infrastructure must go hand in hand to ensure the full realization of both. If we have an educated population, we have to provide a way for them to participate as 21st century economy participants. I'll leave my comments at that. I think this is an important opportunity for the state, and I hope that it will help us leverage those opportunities that I've described in Southwest Alaska, and I urge you to move HCR 32 forward as soon as possible. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Senator Stevens, could I ask you to withdraw your amendment?
If you let me speak to it, fine.
Only because I'm having a better idea, I think. But, yeah, certainly speak to your amendment.
Well, I'm not going to withdraw my amendment then. No. Let me just say that, Chairman, I take to heart what Senator Davis has said, and I would hate to see us killed us by dragging it out, since we are so close to the end, so I will withdraw my amendment.
Thank you. And then I would point out to the members that there are seven members at large chosen jointly by the Speaker of the House, President of the Senate. So they get to fight over an odd number, and I was thinking that if we were going to reduce any group, that would be appropriate to reduce that to six, and then you could add the Commissioner of Administration or her designee. I'm going to let that idea soak for a while and put this at the bottom of the pile, and we will bring it back up at the end of the meeting. That brings us to HB 490. Hello.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tom Nelson. I am the Employment Security Director for the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. The proposed statute changes are largely housekeeping and clarification of existing statute. The changes provide Alaska language alignment with federal law and will bring us into compliance with the unemployment insurance overpayment arrangement we have with other states. If it please the committee, I, along with the representatives of the Alaska Department of Law, can speak to each section of the bill or answer any questions you may have.
I don't see any
questions at this point? Has there been opposition to the bill?
To my understanding, there hasn't been opposition. I believe in, Mr. Chairman, in the House Judiciary Committee, there were some recommended changes that I believe were then withdrawn by the time it got to Senate State Affairs.
Well, let's get to the rest of the testimony, and that may generate some questions if you'd stay with us for a few minutes.
Sure.
Bill Kramer, is it? To answer questions, okay. Toby Steinberger on teleconference.
Good afternoon. My name is Toby Steinberger, and I'm an assistant attorney general, and I'm here. I'm here to describe sections 1 through 3 and 8 of the bill, or I can answer questions. Which do you prefer?
Well, let me see if we have questions first. Is it a fair depiction to say that this is a cleanup legislation and technical in nature, that we're not making substantive changes? Is that correct?
Primarily that's true for sections 4 through 7, well, except for sections 1 through 3 of the bill, there is some change. It's not necessarily a cleanup.
Would you go over those changes then, please?
Sure. Sections 1 through 3 of the bill deal with allowing the release of employment security records for criminal investigation and prosecution purposes. Those sections will help federal, state, and municipal prosecutors to investigate and prosecute criminal cases, because it will help them locate where suspects, witnesses, victims, and persons on parole or probation work. As a matter of background, employers provide payroll information for each employee quarterly to the Employment Security Division when they pay their employment security taxes. So the location where people work is very current information. The Employment Security Division provides unemployment compensation benefits to qualifying persons. And for those people, the division also has up-to-date location information. And also, it's important to note that the Employment Security Division is heavily federally funded. The U.S. Department of Labor has required that employment security records be kept confidential, but has allowed for a number of exceptions. And accordingly, Alaska Statute 2320-110 has allowed for these exceptions. But none of these exceptions allow for releasing of information for criminal prosecution and investigation purposes, other than in prosecuting cases against claimants who have fraudulently received unemployment compensation benefits. This amendment will allow the Criminal Division, for example, to find suspects, witnesses, and even victims, since this information is so up-to-date. When a crime is investigated and we get all the witness statements, by the time the case goes to trial, people have moved, and by finding out where they work, they can then relocate these people. Or if people are on probation or parole and their officers have lost contact with them, this information will help to locate where they work. The U.S. Department of Labor has reviewed this amendment and has approved it, and the U.S. Department of Labor has permitted other states to allow the release of employment security information for purposes of criminal investigations and prosecutions. And these other states include Washington, Iowa, Arkansas, Georgia, Utah, and Oklahoma. I'm not going to answer any other questions you might have.
All right, thank you. I don't see any questions at this time. We have Bill. Bill, you are going to be here just for answering questions. Yeah. All right. Thank you. Questions?
Mr. Chairman, I understand sections 1, 2, and 3 now. Maybe someone can just give us a quick overview of what happens in the rest of the bill.
Mr. Nelson, would you be the appropriate person on that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Senator French, Sections 4 and 12 authorize the department to adopt regulations providing for the distribution of unclaimed excess contributions. Sections 5 and 6 clarify statute by adding the terms manager and limited liability company to existing definitions. Section 7 brings Alaska into conformity with the interstate reciprocal overpayment recovery arrangement that we have with other states and provides the Employment Security Division the ability to collect unemployment insurance overpayments on behalf of other states for reasons other than fraud. States participating in this agreement already provide this service to Alaska. Section 8 adds the definition action, means a court or administrative proceeding not brought under this chapter or an arbitration proceeding, and simply UI appeal adjudications and information applied to the payment of benefits or the payment of benefits only or the adjudication of a benefits activity. Section 10 aligns Alaska language with federal law by clarifying which health care professionals are excluded from the definition of employment. Only student nurses and medical interns are excluded, and this clears up existing language. Section 11 clarifies language that provides an exclusion from the definition of wages for payments or benefits provided by the employer for educational assistance to its employees. Federal law already provides this exclusion from their definition of wages. And Section 13 is the immediate effective date clause.
Thank you. Other questions? Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House Bill 490? We'll close public testimony. Any amendments? Seeing none, will of the committee?
Chairman, I'd move House Bill 490 out of committee with individual recommendations and attached this one.
Okay.
Yes.
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 So 490 is on its way. You will stand at ease for a moment. That brings us to House Bill 559, State Training and Employment Program. And Mr. Bonfire himself is with us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Tom Wright, staff to Representative John Harris. This bill is introduced by the House Finance Committee, and it reauthorizes the STEP program for another 4 years. It's due to sunset June 30th of this year. The reauthorization is until June 30th, 2008. STEP uses a small part of the unemployment insurance tax, and that's used to fund training for Alaskan workers. This program is administered by the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development and the Alaska Investment Board. Workforce Investment Board is the agency that provides oversight and direction for this program. Any questions? Commissioner O'Clery and Guy Bell from the department are here.
Questions? Seeing none. We do have a 7-page amendment, but set, Commissioner, set. Will of the committee.
Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill 559 from the committee with individual recommendations, attached fiscal note.
Okay.
Senator Davis?
Yes.
Senator Seeker?
Yes.
Senator Stevens?
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
Thank you, Mr.
You're welcome. 559 is on its way. That brings us to House Bill 512, Hydrogen Energy Research Program. And do we have anyone here to present the bill?
I think I saw a person.
Here we go.
Yep.
Representative Mudbug, welcome.
Thank you.
Term of endearment for the rest of you.
You could call me worse, couldn't you?
We have. Representative Crawford, would you care to present your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is to set up a hydrogen energy partnership. And I know I'm going to be accused of overusing this analogy, but what Wayne Gretzky, the hockey great, said was the difference between him and all the other highly talented skaters in the National Hockey League was that he always tried to skate where he thought the puck was going to be, not where it was. And I believe that this is the future, that Alaska, even though we depend on our natural gas and our oil right now, that the fuel of the future is going to be hydrogen. And we have a great, huge potential in that we have geothermal, we have water and wind and coal, all of these things, and we need to be able to transfer our energy to places where that energy can be used. And the way to do it is with hydrogen. And I have a very able staffer here that can take over and answer questions, and I'd be glad to help answer any questions that anybody might have.
You have no concerns about this undermining the need to develop ANWR?
Nope. And none whatsoever. I have gone out and lobbied across the country to open ANWR. I believe that that's something that we should do to immediately address our energy concerns and to lessen our dependence on foreign oil. But I think that this is something that we need to start doing now because, the new Governor Schwarzenegger down in California is going to put together a network so that there'll be no place in California where there's not a pump for hydrogen that's more than 20 miles away from another one. I've seen, and you were at NCSL as well, you've seen the hydrogen cars. You know that they're just, they're the wave of the future. And plus the ability to have, the type of small power plant fuel cells that we can put in local communities that we can run off of hydrogen. It's just a fine idea. And the big plus is it's non-polluting. I can't see any minuses on this thing.
It's going to give a lot of environmentalists lack of cause if you find non-polluting energy sources. questions for Representative Crawford. Senator Seekin.
Section 3. What section of statute are you talking about that you're going to add to paragraph 44?
That's actually under the Department of Community and Economic. For the record, this is Jay Hardenbrook, staff to Representative Crawford. That's under the Department of Community and Economic Development.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Seekin.
Talking about funding, I see it says that they shall seek, but it doesn't say that they shall not do anything if they don't get funding. Is this just to be funded by the state if they don't get?
Yes, Senator Seekin, through the chair, this is Jay Hardenbrook again. That question did come up in House Finance, and there are, you'll see the conditional effect and the various different sunset dates at the end. It is made so that if they do not get funding by the year 2009, it will go away. And currently, the Department of Community and Economic Development set up the fiscal note so that it would be funded by program receipts. And currently, they're working with ADA to be able to kind of do a partnership through them as well, so that even the initial position just to find the grants to start the partnership won't even have a fiscal note for the state.
We'd point out there is an initial fiscal note from Community Economic Development.
Yep.
Other questions? We do have someone on teleconference who'd like to testify. Mr. McCutcheon.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
For the record, my name is Jerry McCutcheon. I support the bill. Schwarzenegger has a fine idea, except he doesn't have any hydrogen. Except that what you can get from this association of natural gas. He then winds up the carbon dioxide, which is supposed to be reason for not for using hydrogen in the first place, and that's fed into the air, and so he's got nothing. Not only that, he loses half the energy. You got to make it up, so that's one time more. And so when you get through, figure it all out, it'll take three times as much natural gas to produce the hydrogen to run something than it would if he just used the natural gas and burned it in a vehicle. So he's got a great idea. The trouble is he just doesn't have any hydrogen. Now, guess what? Alaska has got the only game in town. You search the West Coast, and it can make hydrogen out of water, the disassociation of water. The point being is California right now, right at this hour, is short of electricity. They can build all the windmills they want to, but all they're going to do is still need them for to produce the electricity they got. They don't have any surplus power, and they don't have any access to any, and they aren't going to get any. When you sit down and end it, the nearest source of hydrogen they've got is the Susitna project. And so I would like to add on page 3, evaluating the market for hydrogen production, contacting the state of California for participation in California's hydrogen highway network. Questions?
I don't see any questions at this time. Thank you, Mr. McCutcheon. Representative Crawford, there was a suggestion for an addition to your proposal.
It wouldn't bother me a bit. I don't want to close down any avenues for new thought. I hadn't heard that before, but we could certainly address that.
Would you accept a conceptual amendment to your proposal to that would include contacting California to let them know of our potential source of hydrogen?
Please wish, I certainly would.
Senator Seekins.
I guess I don't have any problem with people forming partnerships to look at the commercial use of hydrogen. I think that can be very easily done based on the market. I'm not as convinced that there's this wave of the future market for hydrogen. I've seen the hydrogen fuel cell vehicles that Ford Motor Company and other manufacturers have. I've seen them for years. I don't see them rushing towards fuel cell technology. If it was something that was that vital, I think private industry would take care of it. We'd be going, people in private industry would be going to the university and other places to form partnerships for research. And I think this is one of those areas where we should leave this to private industry.
Senator Davis, did you, were you seeking?
No, I wasn't seeking the floor at that time.
Rather than do a conceptual amendment, I see this does go to finance, so if we'd like to add that, maybe we'd be able to do it in a more efficient fashion. Any other testimony on House Bill 512? Any amendments? Opposed public testimony, the will of the committee?
I'd be honored to make a motion to move.
Okay. I'd like to make it.
Don't fight, children.
I'd like to.
Senator Davis.
My rep. I'd like to move Senate Bill. Not a bill. Excuse me. House Bill, I'm sorry. House Bill 512.
Yeah.
I just crossed it today, by the way.
Yeah. Jane?
Senator French?
Yes.
Senator Stevens?
Yes.
Senator Davis?
Yes.
Senator Seekins?
No.
Senator Bundy?
Yes. So we have moved 512 from committee. I'm looking for 272 right now, and I'm having a little trouble finding it.
Thank you.
Oh, we just got it. You're welcome. Thank you. While we're waiting for 272, I'd like to readdress the SCR 32. I notice it does go to finance, and I do sit on finance, and if I give the amendment some further thought and address it there, so the chair would entertain a motion to move SCR 32. Under Stevens.
I move SCR 32 out of committee on the finance with the attached fiscal note and individual recommendations.
HCR.
Jane? Yeah, no changes.
Senator Speaker?
Yes.
Senator Prince?
Yes.
Senator Stevens?
Yes.
Senator Davis?
Yes.
Senator Bundy?
We'll find out what those are.
Yeah. Yes. Brief at ease. Jane, in front of us, Senate CS for House Bill 272. I'd like to have a motion to adopt the CS as our working document.
Move CS for House Bill 272 / Sierra as our working document, Mr. Chairman.
Without objection, that is our working document. And Senator Seekin?
Mr. Chairman, just for the record, if people don't know by now, I've spent millions of dollars in vain, but I am an automobile dealer.
What brand? Oh, sorry.
Mr. Chairman, I have bought automobiles, so...
Your conflicts are duly noted and ignored. We have Representative Wyrock's staff here. Welcome.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Linda Sylvester, staff to Representative Bruce Wyrock, the sponsor of HB 272. You have just to give you a real brief background, in 2002, the legislature passed an omnibus bill that dealt with automobile dealers and manufacturers and some consumer protection issues. And that was a collaborative effort by the Dealers Association, the Attorney General Ed Sniffen, the Assistant AG Ed Sniffen, and Representative Lisa Murkowski and Representative Andrew Halcrow. The bill was, there was tons of work into that bill. In the 2 years that it's been out there, it's become apparent that there's some just technical changes that need to be made. There's some unenforceable provisions in the bill. That is the bill that you have before you. There was some controversy associated with HB 272, and that has been eliminated as of the Transportation Committee substitute. That Section 1 has been deleted and replaced with Section 10, which is it's a request by the legislature to the Assistant AG to continue to investigate and then report back on the problematic situation that that we felt existed. That report will be due to the legislature on the 25th of January, 2005. That's all of the introductory remarks I have to make. Ed Sniffen is online, and he's very well acquainted with the legislation and worked together with the Automobile Dealers Association to draft it. And then in the audience is Steve Allwine from the Alaska Automobile Association.
I note this is a pretty slim packet without a lot of backup. I think we would have benefited from some history of the controversy as it went through here.
The entire bill file is made up of, it deals exclusively with Section 1, which has been deleted, and there wasn't too much.
We're always curious. Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just curious, what are the problems that you encountered that you want to correct by removing Section 1?
I think that Senator Seekins would be aptly situated to clarify that issue.
I'm more than willing to tell about some of the history there, Mr. Chairman, having followed it all through the process. And basically, there are, of course, it may be slanted from my viewpoint, but there are current laws in the state of Alaska that prohibit someone from selling a vehicle that is new or as a new vehicle if they don't have a franchise to sell that vehicle. There are a number of reasons for that, and there are some, there have been a number of problems associated with those vehicles and regarding warranties, the date of the warranty, the duration of the warranty, who the warranty applies to, if there is a warranty at all, service contracts that are represented as warranties when indeed they're service contracts. And the association attempted to put some clarifying language in there in the bill to try to deter, to further define and more carefully define what would be considered a new vehicle and what would be considered a used vehicle or a non-new, I guess, vehicle. And as a result, some of the used car dealers who are selling vehicles as new that don't have franchises caused a lot of hubbub about the idea and further consideration. The Alaska Automobile Dealers Association said they would forego trying to redefine that and just ask the Department of Law, which is in Section 10, to monitor and investigate the consumer and enforcement problems associated with the current law and report back to the legislature, the next legislature, the 24th legislature, so that there can be a better documentation of some of the concerns that were put out there, whether they are there or they are not there. And I think by doing that, it was a wise choice for the association. I, as a member of the association, agreed with their decision, and I thought by having the data there for them to take a look at a future date was a better way to approach their concern.
Let me go to Mr. Sniffen from Department of Law, who is online, who then perhaps give his view of the history of the bill and the goals. Mr. Sniffen?
Yes, thank you, Chairman. Ed Sniffen with the Department of Law in Anchorage. I have been working with the various automobile dealers associations and the legislature to try and come up with a remedy to the problem just described by Senator Seekins. And we hit sort of a snag in coming up with some language that would resolve the problem to everyone's satisfaction. So we are happy to continue looking into that issue. And the issue is primarily whether or not we want to allow used car dealers to import current model year low mileage vehicles and sell them as used cars, but while at the same time compete with franchised new car dealers. And there are a variety of problems with that issue. And I think the Dealers Association raised this initially because we currently have a law that prevents anyone, any dealer, from selling a used car as a new car, unless the car has what we call the manufacturer's statement of origin, or MSO. And so right now, under Alaska law, I could go to every new car dealer in Alaska, and if they have a used 2004 vehicle on their lot, I would have to take it away from them, because the current law says you can't sell the 2004s until the 2005s come out. So let's say you have serviceman Joe, who buys 2004 Dodge Ram 1500, has it for a few months, gets deployed to Iraq, needs to sell it. He has a difficult time selling it to a dealer because no dealer, franchised or otherwise, could turn around and sell that car until the 2005 model year was available. So that was the problem we are trying to address, and I'm confident we can work with the associations to come up with a fix to that over the recess and report back to the legislature next session. The other part of the bill that is before you today, however, forms the bulk of the legislation, and as Linda Sylvester pointed out earlier in her testimony, it is primarily a cleanup bill to correct some language that just didn't sound right in the prior statute, and to remove some provisions that, through our experience in working with this bill for a year and a half or so, just really didn't apply up here in Alaska. And there has been no opposition that I'm aware of to any of the provisions in the remaining sections of the bill. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions the committee has, and thank you for your time.
don't see any questions, so thank you, Mr. Sniffen. Let's go to Steve Allwine, who's with us here in Juneau, share his view. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Steve Allwine. I am an automobile dealer here in Juneau, and I'm also currently the Secretary of the Alaska Auto Dealers Association. Essentially, what you've heard from Senator Seekins and Attorney General, the Attorney General's office, Ed Sniffen, is what we have all come to terms to. We don't feel at this juncture that there is enough data, and so we all collectively felt that it was appropriate to defer Section 1 till a future date. The rest of it is essentially housekeeping. I was also involved in the original bill with then-Representative Lisa Murkowski in the formation of that bill, and we've just found a few things that may work in the rest of the world really don't make a lot of sense in Alaska. So I'm here just to lend our voice in support of the current committee substitute.
I see no questions, so thank you.
Thank you.
Is there any further public testimony on Senate bill or Senate substitute for House Bill 272? Seeing none, no amendments. The will of the committee.
Chairman, I'd move Senate CS or CS for House Bill 272 out of committee with individual recommendations passed.
Senator French?
Yes.
Senator Seekins?
Yes.
Senator Davis?
Yes.
Senator Seekins?
Yes.
Senator Bundy?
Yes. 272 is on its way. That brings us to House Bill 542, an act relating to specialty construction contractors and to construction contractor exemptions and certain alliterations.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Sue Stancliffe, staff to Speaker Cott. Before you is a labor and commerce bill. Speaker Cott and Representative Anderson had this brought to them collectively and offered it as a labor and commerce committee bill. It's meant to provide a solution to the growing issue of unregistered contractors providing construction services illegally under the guise of a handyman license. Under current law, 0818, there are minimum requirements for a person who represents themselves as either a contractor or a specialty contractor. Instead of meeting the qualification standards and insurance requirements, OCC Licensing currently has issued over 1,600 business licenses to these construction-related exempt from contractor registration. This bill does two things. It will lower the construction limit, the project limit, from 10,000 down to 5,000 and expands the work that can be done by a specialty contractor. This should make this category of business less desirable and currently certainly hope to lessen the abuses. The Department of OCC Licensing or Division of OCC Licensing Director is here and can elaborate on this problem, and we're trying to help the contractors solve this dilemma.
Seeing none at this time.
Thank you.
I'd like to go off net to Eden Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Eden Larson, President and CEO of Associated Builders and Contractors. We represent 145 member companies, primarily commercial construction contractors around the state. I would just like to go on the record to say that we support this bill. We think it's an important step in the right direction to control unlicensed contracting in the state.
Thank you. And I don't see any questions at this time. Thank you. We'll note for the committee the other information in the packets supporting the bill. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on this bill? Senator French.
I don't want to testify, but I guess I just have a couple questions.
Yeah.
Are we going to hear from Mr. Urien?
Oh, yes, please.
Thank
I'm you. Sorry. Didn't have you on the list, Rick, but always welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Rick Urien. I'm the Director of the Division of Occupational Licensing. Before you is a bill that deals with a subject matter known as handyman. And it's a license category that creates more than its fair share of problems in the little division that I head up across the street. We have more complaints in this area than anywhere else. And the problem is that these people do work. They're unlicensed and not bonded or not licensed, uninsured and not bonded. They do a bad job or they walk off a job, and there's no recourse for the consumer. and the bill before you, we think, will help solve some of the problem. There is a need for these people that do work as handymen. We have, internally, we have administratively changed the business license used to be listed under construction exempt. We've changed that now to a service, and they're actually called a handyman. For the first time ever, they're actually called a handyman now. So there'll be less confusion, and we think we'll get them in line to do the work that they should be doing, and contractors can do the work that they should be doing. Senator French.
Is a handyman a specialty contractor?
The chair, Senator French, they were, under the way the law is written, they were a specialty contractor. That's correct. But they were exempt from construction. It's like saying that you're a lawyer, but you're exempt from having a law degree.
And so what does this Section 3 do? That redefines a specialty contractor means a contractor other than a mechanical contractor whose business operations aren't described in AS 08-18024B. Well, I mean, what does that mean?
What we allow under the way the law is, the bill before you will allow people who are now specialty contractors. This handyman is a different category. They're under specialty contractors, a different category. All specialty contractors, which are bonded and insured contractors, can now do all the work that a handyman can do. So we're allowing the people who are bonded and insured to do what we've been allowing people who are not bonded and not insured to do.
And why lowering the limit? What problem is that going to fix? Lowering from $10,000 to $5,000, the limit on project cost.
It will put them into the repair business and keep them out of the construction, being contractors, frankly.
Chairman, I just have to put on the record that I own apartment houses in Anchorage. We have a handyman we use. I couldn't get along without him. He's got a Murkowski Lehman bumper sticker, and I don't care. He's a good guy. He does good work at a good price, and I just don't want to threaten his ability to come over to my place and do work. Because it's very, you know, he's fulfilling a great economic niche.
There are many very capable people in this category, and there are those who aren't capable. And
is there anything in this bill that's going to force him to go get a license or pay more?
He's going to be able to license. He has to be a license, but he can only do his work that he does for you will be no more than $5,000.
That's per project?
Per project.
Did I see Senator Stevens?
Yes.
And I was just going to raise the cost of hiring a handyman. Are they going to be required to do something that's going to cost them more to be in business that they'll have to pass on to the consumer?
The chair, Senator Stevens, no. If you do a work for up to $5,000, you will have to do no more than you do today. They only have a license. They do not have bonding, and they do not have insurance. They have no overhead. We're not making them do that. But if you're going to get work done more than $5,000, you hire a person who is bonded and is insured.
Do you think Senator French should be paying more to his handyman?
I do not think so.
Okay, maybe we should vote on whether we think he should. You'd mentioned that specialty contractors can do what handymen do now. Well, there wasn't anything that kept them from doing that before, was there?
Yes, under the existing law, specialty contractors can do three specialties. They pick three, any three, and this is throws in a fourth one, you know, a freebie, so to speak.
I understand. Thank you. Other questions for Mr. Urien? Amendments? Will of the committee. Senator Stevens.
I move House Bill number 542 out of committee with the attached fiscal note and individual recommendations.
Jane. And it looks like we have the Tom Anderson day because we have one last bill, HB 421, sponsored by Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We felt that it would be only appropriate to have as many bills in this committee as the good chairman had in House Labor and Commerce yesterday.
Thank you for pointing that out.
Once again, for the record, my name is Josh Appleby, staff to Representative Tom Anderson. Before you right now is House Bill 421. It was brought forward by the Alaska Land Title Association as a way to help people clear titles to their homes. Also, 421 has the support of other sectors of the housing industry, including the Alaska Mortgage Bankers Association, the Alaska State Home Builders, and has been reviewed and discussed with many Alaska housing industry sectors, the realtors, the bankers, as many as possible. The intent and purpose of this bill is simple. Once a loan is paid, title must be cleared. For example, you just paid off your home mortgage. The lien on your home is usually held by a mortgage servicer, and it should be reconveyed and taken off the books. And in the future, if you go to sell or refinance your home, you don't want to have that old lien still sticking out there. Well, what happens now is there's no requirement that they reconvey and show that the loan has been paid off. Most banks in Alaska really keep a home loan for longer than 30 days. They'll sell the mortgage to a servicing company, and most of these companies are located outside the state. And so once you pay off your loan, there's no requirement for that servicer to make sure that the reconveyance is taken care of at the recorder's office. During testimony in some of the previous committees, one title insurance company stated that over 1,400 deeds of trust were pending reconveyance. That means that there could literally be thousands of deeds of trust out there statewide that need to be reconveyed and should be reflected that the mortgage is paid off. This problem has arisen in other states. The current bill is crafted after a law passed in Idaho 3 years ago, and that law has proven to be very helpful in getting the reconveyances recorded and cleaned up in a more timely fashion. The deeds of trust that are covered under this bill are only those deeds of trust held by title insurance companies. So it does not open the door and give the opportunity of simply wiping out debts or any other obligations established by deeds of trust not held by title companies. If you look through the bill, you'll see that the bulk of it establishes the notification process and the forms that must be sent by the title insurance company to the homeowner, that's the beneficiary, and the mortgage servicer. This is intended to ensure a solid notification process with quality control and integrity. We should have on the phone Brian Merrill from First American Title if you have any specific questions about the process in which deeds of trust get recorded and reconveyed.
We will get to him in a moment. Can you help me with my understanding? As you point out, mortgage isn't often held by a
servicer,
a bank. It's now, whose responsibility now will it be to make sure that the reconveyance happens in a timely fashion? The person who originally created the mortgage, the people they sell it to, or the title company?
Well, specifically, it would be the servicing company who, you know.
The one who ended up owning the mortgage. Thank you.
Mr. Merrill, do you have some comments you'd like to add?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Brian Merrill. I'm the immediate past president of the Alaska Land Title Association. I'm also state agency manager, counsel, and underwriter for First American Title Insurance Company, the largest underwriter of title insurance in the state of Alaska. Mr. Appleby has already explained basically what the bill does and what it's for. The association brought it forward as an alternate means to assist consumers who have not been successful in having their lenders release mortgage instruments that have been paid off through past transactions. It would only be those transactions that we have sufficient information proving that the deed of trust has been paid off as required by the bill that we would be able to release in the industry through this process after notification to the mortgage lender and the servicer in accord with what the notification requirements are. So it's a good piece of consumer legislation. We haven't heard any opposition to the bill that we haven't been able to deal with some modifications to the bill made through the House committees that heard the bill. The bill passed the House 38-0, so I think it's something that everybody agrees is a good idea. And I would be happy to answer any questions the committee has.
Questions for Mr. Merrill? I don't see any at this time. Thank you, Mr. Merrill. Further questions about the bill? Anyone else like to testify? Close public testimony. Will of the committee.
I make a motion that we move this bill out of committee 512. We will attach this note, individual recommendations.
Actually, it's House Bill 421.
421.
So House Bill 421 has been moved from committee, and the take the roll, please, Jane.
Senator Stevens?
Yes.
Senator Davis?
Yes.
Senator French?
Yes.
Senator Stevens?
Yes.
Senator Bundy?
Yes. So that brings us to the bottom of our calendar. I do anticipate one more meeting on Thursday. However, in the event that doesn't occur, let me give my most heartfelt thanks to my fellow committee members for their bright and insightful questions, Senator French, for faithful attendance, Senator Davis, for thoughtful, educated comments, Senator Stevens, and for your automotive expertise and your appropriate and skillful motions, Senator Deacon. To Jane,
well timed.
Many thanks for putting up with our erratic schedule. So
and for treats.
Yeah, and for
treats.
For Jane and her treats. To Ann, our ever patient and long suffering minute taker, we certainly thank you. And thanks to the folks on teleconference and the folks out at the LIOs, and we have some. Like I said, I anticipate a meeting on Thursday, but in the event that it doesn't occur, thanks to all who helped make Senate Labor and Commerce.
Likewise, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and we will stand adjourned.
Please sign that.